Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Lombardi, author of the book, I Ain't Marching Anymore, Dissenters, Deserters, and Objectors to America's Wars. Chris, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for interest.
Chris Lombardi is a journalist and author who is interested in how ordinary people interact with the decisions of those in power. She has an MS in journalism from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and an MFA in Literature and Creative Writing from City College of New York. Her work has appeared in The Nation, Guernica, The Philadelphia Inquirer, the ABA Journal, and at WHYY.org. Today, I'll be talking to her about her new book, I Ain't Marching Anymore, Dissenters, Deserters, and Objectors to America's Wars. Chris, I'm really interested in how you started to get interested in this topic all the way back in the sixth grade. Can you talk about what sparked your interest?
In the sixth grade? Oh, you know, my Howard Levy story. I was in sixth grade and I was, and one of the kids who reads all the books in the library, and it handed me a book she was reading. It happened to be a book called Going to Jail by Howard Levy. Howard Levy was a resistor who was in jail for not allowing training other Vietnamese doctors and so forth. And I'm in sixth grade, you know, 11, and I'm learning that there are Americans who are political prisoners. And I think my mind started to be blown by that moment.
Yeah, I suppose that would be quite surprising. So where did you go next from there? How did you pursue that curiosity?
Well, you know, I've always been a writer. I wrote fiction for a long time, and my fiction always involved some factual stuff. I wrote one novel about the Holocaust, one novel about James Joyce's daughter who was in mental hospital, blah, blah. A lot of research. And I eventually discovered realized I was a journalist. And meanwhile, I got hired to work for a peace group in California called the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, which helps people who have figured out that they don't believe in war and even when they're in the military. And when I started there in the 90s, they coordinated something called the GI Rights Hotline. You find out about GIRights.org. And that meant that here I was, this writer who was hired by this peace group, talking to soldiers every single day. And it changed my life again. Because there's suddenly those soldiers or somebody like me who wanted to do something big. And doing that, I was coordinating hotline with Vietnamese, Vietnam War veterans. And they were, like many Vietnam veterans that you see in the media, very smart and very passionate. And I learned a lot from them. And I would joke that, you know, it's going to be a revolution. It's going to be from progressive anti-war veterans. That's how we, the people who know what's going on. And that idea stayed with me for a long time. And eventually, when I was at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, I told somebody that I wanted to write a book about the GI Rights Hotline. I thought it was interesting, you know. It was about a hotline that had, you know, lefty and students and ministers on one end, and then a soldier calling because he's got trouble on base on the other. And I told this to my professor, and he said, you know, why don't you broaden it? Why don't you write a narrative history of soldiers who dissent? And here I am at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, really wanted to get in this class, book writing. And I'm like, okay, we'll do that. And that turns out to be a massive project that has taken me 15 years.
Wow. Well, you definitely cover a wide breadth of history going back prior to the American Revolution all the way to the present day. I can't imagine what it must have been like to try and parse that down into chapters and into a readable narrative. Was that difficult for you?
Well, the first proposal had everything up to the 20th century be one chapter. It would do some 19th century stuff, some Civil War stuff, and boom, and now I'm in World War I. That was what the University of California agreed for me to do. But meanwhile, I started doing my research, and oh my God, there's so much, especially when I started to sort of integrate the idea of what kind of descent I was talking about.
And I'm also interested in how you took your background in journalism and combined it with your background in creative writing and created a story, a narrative out of these smaller examples of descent. Can you talk about the craft of making each chapter into a narrative?
Well, I remember at one point I was looking at all of the narratives of history everybody writes, right? And how do I do this? How do I create characters out of these? All I have is pieces of paper. All I have is words, or sometimes it's all I have is interviews. I interviewed a lot of Vietnam and Iraq war veterans. How do I turn my words on paper and on the screen into a story? And I drew from people like Neil Doctorow, who wrote The March, and Adam Hochschild, who wrote King Leopold's Ghost, and how they managed to make scenes out of things. And deciding that for every chapter, I had to have characters, people who I knew about, turned into characters just from the stuff I had to know about them, and turned them into my broader themes. It was always tricky.
Now, was it? How did you decide which characters to use? Such as in the beginning, you use a gentleman named Jacob Ritter, who I found very interesting. You must have had to choose between several different historical figures.
Yeah, I have my cutting room has a lot of people that didn't end up getting used. But Jacob Ritter was a fairly natural choice because there aren't that many in the 18th century on record that we know about. I mean, there are enough. There are more than we know about. But in terms of people have enough on paper to know about what's going on with them. And I had already written the book. It was getting it in various drafts. But Sarah Vowell discovered Jacob Ritter and mentioned him in her biography of Jefferson. And she said, Battle Bridegroom was really bad because somebody showed up a Lutheran and ended up a Quaker, which is what happened to Jacob Ritter. So he's a compelling person to everybody, I think.
I was interested in how there is a lot more than just the traditional descent of maybe going to Canada and avoiding the draft. There was all kinds of uniform descent. There was written descent. There was religious descent. Can you clarify how many different kinds of descent did you focus on throughout this book?
Well, for one thing, I don't actually cover people who go to Canada. The conceit of the book is someone in it has to have had an experience with the military. That can be broadly defined. For example, I had residence there, and all he did was an ROTC for a while and dropped out. But someone who had some experience with the military, and therefore they went on to challenge what the military does. But that means I left out a lot of people in terms of people who did very amazing dissent against the government. But people who it has to be somebody who was in your uniform, even if it's only 5 minutes. And as you say, there's I think of it as kind of a reverse funnel. You could say that the people that the book is about is conscious objectors to war, and that's true. But I start, especially in the beginning of the book, to include a wide variety of people who stood up against something based on a fairly large mix of things. But it's eventually, it turns out to this critical mass of people who are standing up against wars. But that takes a long time.
Well, of course, it's not just war. And I think that's one of the most fascinating parts about this novel, about this book, I'm sorry, is...
Oh, I love what you call a novel.
Is that you are able to broaden it far, much farther beyond war, objecting to war, but it's about objecting to injustice, inequality, racism, all those sorts of things. Can you talk about how people, what they were fighting against when they were objecting to war?
They're fighting against, you know, think about the oath that people take in the military. We all took it when we were, if you've ever worked for government, you know, you've seen that stuff when you see the president talks about defending the U.S. Constitution. And that's these people. And they take it really seriously. You know, I've interviewed many people, many young soldiers and veterans, and one of the first things they do is tell me all the values of their service. Army values, the Navy values, the Marine Corps values. And they're all, you know, things like selfless service, integrity, honor. And the vow is to protect the Constitution. It's not to fight for every single little thing that a commander has decided to do. And what that means, in terms of, you say, racism, that the definition of citizenship for these soldiers, they didn't understand why some people were not included in that citizenship. And they needed to show that they were going to fight for that. And that includes sometimes understanding that you're on stolen land, as we say now, that the Indians that this land was taken from need to be honored as well. Not enough about that, I know.
What about gender discrimination? How much of dissent is based on that inequality, both in gender discrimination and in sexism, and how the military has had to change over time based on recognizing the values of those marginalized, traditionally marginalized people?
The theme I called one is for fighting, one is for fun. Traditionally, the military mindset is very masculinist. And because for reasons of needing bodies, they needed to expand the military, and they said, okay, we'll allow women. The women were always there. In the revolution, the women in male uniforms leaving in their country, and therefore they were fighting. In the Civil War, same thing. And so women who were at all involved in the military or involved in the wars had a role and had to fight for it to be recognized. Harriet Tubman is a good example. Who, you know, besides the Underground Railroad stuff, she, you know, did battles. She trained soldiers. She was a recruiter. And she finally got veterans compensation decades and decades after the war. For a long time, she was living just on her husband's veterans compensation. So it's important. And the other thing about gender dissent is, of course, that the whole business around gays in the military, which for a long time, being gay in the military meant that you were dissenting right there. And that only changed, 10 years ago now? The long history of that. And that's not my main topic, because there are many people who are gays in the military who are, you know, we can fight better. And we can be the enforcer. And that's a delicate thread to do in terms of what I'm looking at. And then the other example, Chelsea Manning, who, by her very existence, challenged a lot of the military masculinity. I said, no, I'm going to be who I am. And that was on top of what other things she was doing. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows about.
What about the juxtaposition of America's wars, fighting for things like freedom, opportunity, and democracy, while at the same time instilling these policies of imperialism and colonialism and genocide?
It's the contradiction that some of these people that I'm writing about had to figure out in their own selves. Wait a minute, I believe in this, but this other stuff is going on, and it's my job to say something. And we can do it on different people. We can talk about Silas Lowell, who fought for John Brown and ended up joining the Union Army because he believed in the fight against slavery. Meanwhile, he was being tasked with dealing with fighting against Indians in Colorado. And he said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to kill all those people you're telling me to kill. That's not what I fought for. It's the Constitution, what I'm trying to fight for here. But it takes a lot of bravery and ability to get to suffer consequence to do that.
Mm. And ultimately, wasn't Silas Sewall killed a few months later.
He was. He was killed. He was killed.
He could testify.
They ordered him to do it. Yeah, yeah. Afterward, I mean, it was revenge. Like, it was all over.
Mm-hmm. Talk about William Appice, one of the first soldiers that can be traced to foundational injustice. What did he do?
William Appice is a wonderful, not wonderful, it's a figure that I really want people to pay attention to. He was African American, and his background was, his father was African American and his mother was Indian, Pequot, and he was in a difficult situation, and therefore he was sent to another family to adopt. He was actually bound out to be an indentured servant, and he said he didn't want that. He's 15 years old. He leaves town, and he's headed for Philadelphia. And on the way, he's staying in a hotel, and a couple of recruiters show up. And they're like, oh, this young man has both all the four limbs, and he speaks English. Let's get him in here. And they got him drunk and told him how wonderful it would be to be a soldier. And he said, okay. He signed up. He suffers racist harassment on his way to Canada, where they were going to be working. And he goes AWOL because, wait a minute, this doesn't work because you hired me to be a drummer and they make me do this. No. They get him back. He fights in the Battle of Montreal. And while he's signing, thinks, you know, I don't know if I should be fighting for the men who took my country away. So he goes back, ends up becoming a minister, and ends up going to Massachusetts because he was told by his father that he should fight for the Mashpee, which is a tribe at this moment is still fighting for recognition, as you know, or you may not know. But he actually helped the Mashpee get more autonomy. His fight for that was part of his still continuing his tradition of descent. He also published a number of books that you should all go find, called The Son of the Soft Forest, and so forth, A-P-E-S-S. His last book was called An Elegy to King Philip, who was the Pequot leader who was massacred in 1676.
Well, it's an incredible story, and I'm glad you included it in this book, and I'll definitely look for more about him. I was also curious, well, this was new to me. You state that by the end of the Civil War, hundreds of women had passed as male in both armies. That was just new. That was fascinating and new to me. Talk about how women fought in the Civil War.
There are books now about this, which is great, that cover it. Women wanted to be part of the struggle. And they you know, did all the things you know women do. Raised money and were medics. A number of them just got dressed up as men. And one of my characters, she actually would go as a servant. So be a kind of low level so much that she was mistaken as for a servant in Southern armies. And then there's one who, I don't remember her name, but her name was Mary Galloway.
And then she
was at the Battle of Antietam. And Clara Barton, remember Red Cross, discovers this so-called young man. Says, wait a minute, I think you have to go home. So some of them do get discovered before. Mm-hmm.
But you say that S.M. Blaylock was discharged, and the reasons were for being a woman.
The discharge paper said for being a woman. Yes, for being a woman. And it's fascinating to me that was accepted as a possibility. Okay, sorry, you're a girl, go.
You also quote a lot of W.E.B. Du Bois, and his writing is just incredible. And it kind of speaks to today and what we're dealing with today in fighting for social justice. And it just kind of struck me that
his Black Reconstruction,
not a lot has changed since then.
A lot has and has not. It's true.
So can you talk a little bit? How he was. I'm sorry.
I feel almost there are so many great scholars who have said been so much about him that I'm a little shy to speak for him as if I'm an expert.
Sure.
But he knew so much. He knew what was going on. And the reason he qualifies for my book is that at one point he got himself a commission. He was actually editor of magazines for NAACP, and they offered him a commission to help train black soldiers in World War I. And this was a guy who has been a pacifist for a long time, hated war, but he wanted to help young black men who were being recruited into this. And they retracted the commission almost immediately because they realized what was going on. They could not let him in. He really had a strong sense of the injustice that was being visited on these people, and that the wars that we have on other lands is another layer of that.
You have a quote by Mark Twain in the book, or you say that Mark Twain was right when he wrote that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And you say, I hope these pages have noticed enough of our past blank verse to be useful. I think that's exactly what you were able to accomplish. And it's just amazing how history does rhyme. It seems to ebb and flow and continue, as you show in this book, all the way back to 1754. Talk about the relevance of that quote.
Well, actually, I used it the other day on Twitter because, unfortunately, Breonna Taylor's trial, the whole thing that happened, that was the 75th anniversary of Emmett Till being killed. And history is literally rhyming right now. That there are times when events echo what has happened before in ways that are worth looking at. That's what history rhymes to me, I think. It doesn't repeat itself, but it there are places where what's happening now can so powerfully evoke what happened before that it's worth talking about.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk again about the process of publishing this book and bringing it out into the world. You said it was a 15-year process. I think I read that originally was going to be published by the University of California Press, and then was eventually published by the New Press. What was that whole process like?
Well, I have to confess that I have health issues, and the University of California grew impatient with how long it was taking me. And after, you know, what was it? 2012, I think, when that contract ended. And I have to say, that was, you know, 8 years they gave me. And I couldn't do it at that point. And it was just difficult to do. But my agent, who's fantastic, said, we'll find somebody else. And the New Press agreed to do it. And I'm so happy with that. I mean, my editor is fantastic. And it's a village to do this kind of stuff. I had a lot of people helping me.
And tell me more about the New Press and about the mission of publishing in the public interest.
Well, the New Press was founded, when was it? 25 years ago, by someone who worked for one of the more prominent publishers that wanted to have found something that was more straightforwardly just for the people. And I'm not really a big student of that process, but I know that they published, for example, New Jim Crow. If there's anything I am proud of, serving a publisher with Michelle Alexander and New Jim Crow, and a lot of amazing books that they've done. And you're not trying to maximize the amount of cash you can bring forth.
Yeah, and I think that's important for books of public interest like this. So your research, you talked about you were working for the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, and you must have had a lot of interactions that kind of sparked some stories that for you to write down. So how did you combine kind of interviews and stories that you were told with actual documents and research that you did in archives?
Well, For interviews, all I have to do is find archives to document what someone told me, right? So it's a little bit easier. And that's actually sometimes in cooperation with the person, depending on who that is. Binding it with historical stuff, I'm trying to figure out how to really convey the difference. The difference is, in when you're dealing with a historical figure, all you have are documents about that person's words and the words of somebody about them. And some of the people that I write about are famous, but some of them are not. And all you have is what they've written or what you can find out about them, about that environment. For example, when I write about the guy, one of the people, Daniel Meeks, in the Port Chicago 50, I need to learn about him, and I find out he grew up in Natchez, Mississippi. And I look at what can I find out about Natchez, Mississippi. But guess what? Guess who wrote about Natchez, Mississippi? Richard Wright. Oh, my God. Guy who could write 10 times better than any of us. I can't write the way he writes, but I get a sense of that setting from him. Mm-hmm. So you get help from people like that sometimes. For factual stuff, it's really a question of looking at the actual, as much as you can, the documents that have the facts you can document, say this is really when this happened and where this happened, including this was the weather that day.
So what are you working on next?
Well, I've been invited to co-write a chapter on conscientious objection for a textbook, the Oxford Handbook of Peace History. It's that kind of textbook, industrial complex stuff. One of the editors of it invited me. He did a book on world peace that I can't afford because it's $50. But
oh, wow.
I'm happy to be invited, and I'm learning so much about it, and I'm considering the idea of doing an international version of 8 March, and although it would be very different than this one, but I'm going to take 15 years to do it, so I'm really different. Thinking about all over the world, how people have wrestled with what the government has told them to do.
Mm. Well, I have to congratulate you on this book. I'm not an expert in military history, but it really brought up first of all, it had some really incredible stories, really incredible narratives in every single chapter. I think it's organized really well chronologically, and it brought up a lot of really important issues that, as I said, are resonating throughout our history all the way to right now, all the way to today. And I think the whole book is just fascinating and really opens up our readers' eyes. It certainly opened up my eyes. So just congratulations on a great book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's so great to have somebody who doesn't know anything about the book.
I didn't want to get into too much of the specifics in this interview because I want readers to be able to delve into the book and read about the stories about William Appice and Jacob Ritter and, you know, on and on and on. And I think they'll really enjoy what they find. Where can readers find the book?
Oh, I want to mention the launch. We have a soft launch on October 3rd at the Center on Consciousness and War, which is an organization related to the one that I worked for. The one that I worked for is no more. But the Center on Consciousness and War has been around 80 years this year, and they're having their anniversary having a Zoom on October 3rd. Go to centeronconscience.org and you can meet some of the people in my book.
Well, great. I will definitely check that out. And yeah, it's nice to be able to go to these book launches. It's unfortunate we can't do in-person events, but it also makes the events accessible for everybody.
True. Yeah. Take care. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I've been talking with Chris Lombardi, author of the book, I Ain't Marching Anymore, Dissenters, Deserters, and Objectors to America's Wars. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.